Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Garrett Broad of Rowan University, and I'm pleased to be your host for this conversation with Christy Spackman, Assistant Professor of the Art and Science Nexus, jointly appointed in the School for the Future of Innovation in Society and the School of Arts, Media, and Engineering at Arizona State University. Christy is the author of The Taste of Water, Sensory Perception and the Making of an Industrialized Beverage. So, tell me, what does your tap water taste like? I think many of us feel quite lucky to say that, well, my tap water doesn't really taste like anything at all. But how did that imperceptible taste of water come to be? And how does that lack of taste shape the way we all think, or don't think, about the environmental problems that surround us? These and many other questions are explored in The Taste of Water, an engaging history of water treatment in the modern industrial age. Christy Spackman, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Garrett.
So to get us started, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself and your professional background?
Sure. Like many academics, I've taken a very windy road to get where I'm at. I did my training initially in molecular biology and chemistry, and while I was a chemistry major, got interested in food. Worked for 5 years as a lab tech doing research at the University of Chicago hospitals, doing cancer research, actually, and then at night ended up going to culinary school. And it was there that I started to realize that there was a whole field that was thinking about food and science and chemistry together. So I changed and headed off to University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign to study some food chemistry. But the questions I wanted to ask were really questions about why people liked the things they liked and how food science practices intersected with those. So that's how I ended up where I am. The art side of it, that's just ASU being really amazing and allowing us to play around with things and to think at problems sideways in very creative ways.
Yeah, that winding history, I think, really comes through in the book that takes us through these different inflection points, as you call it, in modern water governance. And your sort of interdisciplinary background there allows you to tell this really interesting and complicated story. So how did you come to focus on this project specifically? And how did you go about investigating methodologically these different inflection points in water management?
That's such a great question, Garrett. When I first started working on this problem, I was actually interested in functional beverages. So things like vitamin water and how, because in 2010, they just had kind of really exploded on the market. It started earlier, but that was the time point at which I started collecting bottles, actually. And my bottle collections at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, in case anyone ever wants to go see a bunch of ephemera from the early 2000s and early aughts. But the thing that really caught my attention as I had been thinking with those, I had a summer dissertation fellowship in France and was going through looking at all of the different grocery stores and small bodegas to essentially see what sorts of functional beverages were being sold there. And one day at home on my dinner table, I realized that the bottle of mineral water my husband was drinking was itself a functional beverage. It had a picture of strong bones and some argument about how this, just what I thought of as an everyday water, was this thing that was going to shape someone's health and their capacity to participate in sports. And from there, I completely changed my focus onto water and ended up being really intrigued by what I refer to as technologies of taste, the things that folks use to manage the tastes and smells in their food supply, and municipal water became the thing I focused on from that.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do? Like, what? There's a lot of archival material here. There's also some interviews. So can you tell us a little bit methodologically? I'm always interested. How did you actually go about investigating this topic?
This is very, so my main methodological thorough point is a follow the thing approach, to be honest. And from there, it was seeing where, starting with that taste and water wilt, how did that lead me around? And where did that take me? And from there, it pretty much became a, what sources do I need to look at? Who do I need to talk to try and understand how this thing, the taste and water, or the taste and odor wilt for raw and treated waters came to be, and what its process was and how it was functioning in the world.
Yeah, and interesting. We'll come back to the taste and odor wheel, and that didn't emerge initially, right? That is kind of the product of decades of this work in water management. So, but key to your whole approach is really encouraging the reader to think of water as a type of food. You say this allows, quote, conversations about taste and smell to bubble up and sit alongside conversations about public health and safety. So what does it mean when you treat water as a foodstuff?
I think treating water as a foodstuff totally changes the way we consider this thing that comes into our house. So again, I have this background in food science from my master's program. And of all of the industrialized food products in the world, only one, at least in the United States, only one gets pumped into your house and is readily and freely available. And when you stop thinking of water just as a utility, but as a food, and recognize that it's this food that you literally don't have to leave your house to get, it's a little mind-blowing from my perspective as far as what it means to then consider and care for this thing. Now, I'm not always particularly good at caring for my food. I was cleaning out my fridge yesterday and had to throw away some very amazing science experiments.
Sure.
But I think that itself is a reminder that there's this relationship with food we have, because it's this thing that nourishes us and it cares. We use it to care for our body and to extend our lives, but we also use it for pleasure and for gathering people together, for forming relationships. And by reframing water that way, and specifically tap water, not just fancy water, it really shifts what we can think about.
And in that process, you call for a focus on what you call sensory data. What is sensory data, and how did you go about exploring sensory data in your research?
So to me, sensory data, obviously it's things we see, but those are things that we often pay attention to. We pay a little bit less attention to things we hear. But when I'm using it this way, I'm including seeing and hearing, but also expanding it to include our experience of tasting, touching, smelling, and all of those taken together, all of those five sensory things combined to form what I think of as everyday expertise. And part of the reason to pay attention to sensory data is it allows us to think about how everyday expertise comes into being. And with regards to water, this is an especially important place where everyday expertise exists. You know, and I know when your water is different. You might not notice on a daily basis that it has specific characteristics that you can perceive, but the second those characteristics change, you're very aware of it. And it's an amazing level of attunement that comes about unconsciously that most people don't spend their days sniffing their water explicitly, but they do actually do it, even if it's unconscious. Mm-hmm. And so when we start thinking about and paying attention to those practices, it really opens up new ways for encountering something that we really take for granted.
Yeah, it's such a good point, right? You only notice the taste when it's off a little bit, right? And off, that's a loaded term, because what does water really taste like is the real question, I think, that this whole book starts with. You really start the book in 1920s Chicago, but prior to that, you know, water had a very different feel. So what did water and taste and smell like and look like before that industrial age, before you start to tell this story of the industrial management in the 1920s? What is unindustrial water like?
That's such a great question, Garrett. And I think it goes back in a way to your methodological question, because how do you capture something that people didn't keep samples of, and even if they had, it would still, it would be different than it was. How do you capture something that people weren't making video recordings of? Tastes and smells are very hard to recreate over time, especially because the ingredients have changed and water's not dissimilar. So how I went about trying to understand the older tastes and smells of water was really just looking at what other people recounted about either the process of encountering the water, or more specifically, when other folks came from other places and encountered the water. And one of the most striking things to me is an account of the of St. Louis getting ready for World's Fair or an exposition. So you have both St. Louis and Chicago at similar time periods, getting ready to encounter folks from outside, and taking care of their water becomes a really big part of the conversation. How do we make our water something that when people come and encounter it, they will favorably judge us instead of unfavorably judge us? And there were two sides to that. In Chicago, it was very specifically health. How do we make sure water doesn't kill people? And anyone who's read Devil in the White City is very aware of some of those conversations. And then on the other side is aesthetics. And in St. Louis, they recount how the water coming out of the taps initially was actually kind of a rusty color. Just it was stained by the land it encountered ahead of time. And, you know, before you install massive filtration plants, before you install chlorination, that really is something that folks could encounter. People who live in areas with well water and high iron content are very aware of this because their white clothes gain a beautiful pink hue after time. Similarly, folks living in New England, it's reported that they had water that was tea colored. This was just due to the natural organic matter in the local waterways. And it's more often that just thinking with those different regional differences really starts to highlight that the fact that when I travel, the water all looks the same and generally feels the same in my mouth is actually pretty abnormal.
And it's quite new. It's a product of the last 100 years or so. And you start to tell us that story in Chicago, the 1920s, 1930s, this key site for developing what you term industrial terroir. What is industrial terroir?
So I have two definitions for industrial terroir, which is an interesting challenge to think with. But the first one is, well, first, let's step back. The term terroir is a French term that is often used in the wine world, and it has been glossed by scholar Amy Trubeck as being essentially the taste of place. And so when I think of industrial terroir, I think of it first as being the taste of place as shaped by industry. And so in the case of Chicago, you can think of Lake Michigan and the way that all of the industrial activity, especially around the south side of the lake, be it from the slaughterhouses to the steel mills to the ironworks, are all dumping discards into the lake. And that is quite significantly impacting the gustatory characteristics of water coming out of Chicago taps and also the health characteristics. And I do want to note, and we'll probably talk about this later, that taste and health have a really interesting relationship. Tasty waters aren't always safe waters. Safe waters aren't always tasty waters. And so it creates a nice tension. And so this taste of place as shaped by industry becomes something that itself requires an additional level of care and labor so that it can remain or become once again a product that people are willing to engage with and happy to engage with. And this is where the second aspect of industrial terroir emerges. So scholars like Colleen Guy recognize that terroir isn't just the taste of the earth, for example, it's also reflective of the labor practices that go into the process and the regulatory systems, et cetera, of making possible a wine that is called a Bordeaux. And in the case of water, you have all of these engineers and other folks working in the water world whose specific responsibility is to care for the water, to try and produce water that isn't not just safe, but also aesthetically pleasing in a regulatory system that actually doesn't really value the aesthetic qualities, but they value it as best they can because it's reflected back on them when they go and deal with city council or with their neighbors.
And And in that process, in Chicago specifically, you mentioned before the drinking water taste and odor wheel as being really central to your investigation here, but it has predecessors. And the first real predecessor you identify is what's called the threshold odor test and the threshold odor number, the TUN. What role did those play, that sort of systematization play, in getting us to this industrial terroir?
So what's really interesting about when you're trying to erase taste, which is one of the core things that what I think of as a core marker of industrial terroir. So remove unwanted tastes and smells to just create whatever ideal flavor profile you're thinking of or gustatory experience. And for these water workers, especially in the Midwest, which is where the American Water Works Association really first formed and was at its strongest, it's now the National Association for Municipal Providers across the United States. They would have these meetings and they recount trying to communicate with each other, hey, I've tried out this new treatment technique. Maybe it was activated carbon, maybe it was something else. And you would have someone in Michigan saying to someone in Springfield, Illinois, hey, I tried this out. It worked. But how well did it work? How do you communicate the effectiveness at removing unwanted tastes and smells? And so these folks start drawing on the field of psychophysics, which is really developed in Europe initially and then came to the United States and is actually one of the many foundations of how we understand marketing, how we understand the way people respond to perceptual cues. And they pulled that discipline in, although it's interesting, they don't seem to explicitly recognize that they're doing it. It's more that they just had encountered sociological papers that were talking about the differences in perception and pulled that in to create a scale for communication about how intense an odor was, with one being something that an expert might recognize, but an everyday consumer like you or I would never detect or even think about, and a five being something that was, you know, completely unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And they would use these numbers, or at least they imagined using these numbers is maybe a better way of saying it, as a way to communicate about the effectiveness. And this ends up getting adopted, I don't have the exact date off the top of my head, that's what books are for, but adopted in the 1930s into the standard methods for water treatment, and persists up through the 70s and 80s, even though, as folks I interviewed more recently have said, it wasn't actually as effective as they'd like to be. So there's this imagination of this perfect world where you can completely master the tastes and smells caused by the environment and by human activity in the environment. So all you get is a pure industrial terroir, essentially.
Right. And again, this sort of placelessness, right, where the water would be the same in Chicago as it would be everywhere else. But as you note, moving into the 1970s and into places like California, there started to be some recognition of the limits of this threshold odor test and the threshold odor number. And they started to do what you call molecularize smell. What happens when we molecularize? What is different when water is molecularized? Excuse me, I struggle to say that. Here. So what does that mean to molecularize smell, and what do they do to put that into practice?
So just a caveat, I again was trained as a chemist initially, and so yeah. I definitely think in a chemical approach to things. So for me, molecularizing smell is the idea of saying smell isn't just an experience where I'm encountering something and it's activating memories in my mind, what I like to think of as smell shadow. But for many of these scientists, smell over in the mid-20th century starts to become something that is distinctly linked to specific molecular identities. And this is enabled in part by the rise of some new chemical analytical techniques, specifically the gas chromatograph connected with an olfactometer. So maybe you remember in high school doing this thing where you would, high school chemistry, you would take some substances and put drops of them on a paper and they were in an aqueous solution and then they would spread up through the paper and mm-hmm. in that spreading process separate out. And a gas chromatograph works that way where it takes a mixture of things and spreads it out essentially into its individual components so you can start to identify, oh, this mix of stuff, this mix of water also has, it's not just H2O, it's also maybe a compound called geosmin, or maybe it has 2-methyl isoborneol in it, or maybe it has D-limonene. And so those last three words I said were words that people didn't necessarily have available to them in the early 1900s, but the rise of these capacities to really use analytical instruments to identify what was present helped create this connection between, hey, this perceptual experience, I smell grass, is linked to this molecule, hexanal. And, you know, perfumers have been doing that for a long time without necessarily using those words, but this opened up the world to others.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, you mentioned, you know, you're matching the perception experience with the molecularization, but there was another big part of this story, which was about bringing in the folks from kind of food and consumer science, flavor science, and blending those methods to better understand how those things matches. What about that collaboration was interesting and different, and how did they bring sort of the perceptions of everyday people into the conversation at that stage?
Sure. So it's important to understand that in the early 1950s, specifically after World War II, there was a lot of concern about, hey, we sent all these soldiers out to fight and we had nutritionally perfect meals and they didn't like them. And so this led to a rapid increase in the field, not just of food science, but also of sensory science, of trying to be able to measure people's perceptual experiences. And most of us have done this taste test. Maybe we've just done it for fun, or you can think of the Coke versus Pepsi challenge, where you're trying to say, hey, can I perceive the differences between A and B? And for the people working in the food industry, that question of can you perceive the difference between A and B is actually a really important question when it comes to profit. So for example, you're in charge of making a box of macaroni and cheese, and you discover that you can save your company a cent or maybe a tenth of a cent per box by swapping out for a different ingredient. And as long as people can't tell a difference, why not use an ingredient from a different supplier or change around your ingredients a little bit? And at scale, that saves you a lot of money over time. And so those practices end up getting developed into something called flavor profile analysis, which is where you're trying to describe flavor in a way that multiple people, again, like with the threshold odor number, have the shared expertise. But unlike the threshold odor number, it's not just related to a number. It's actually saying, hey, this perceptual experience I'm having, I can name the same way you can name your perceptual experience. And so you get this scientific approach to what previously had been a much more arts-based, if you will, or humanistic practice of describing perceptual experience.
Yeah,
and in the 70s, the water workers end up pulling in this approach to help them deal with problems. And flavor profile analysis now isn't really used much in the food world and still is the gold standard in the water world.
Yeah, and it's just, it was really interesting in your story, the way these kind of different approaches combined to lead us to this this more kind of holistic, I suppose you could say, approach. But then there's also this whole story about what's been going on in France. You mentioned that your time in France helped sort of spark your interest in this particular project. You spent a good deal of time in the French context in this book. So how did French sensibilities influence water management? You talk specifically about this idea of thinking about the future sensing body. What does the French approach do that's maybe different or interesting in this history of water management around this, you know, late 20th century time?
Sure. So just to take a step back, I think it's important to recognize that the French collaboration that led to the Taste and Odor Wheel that we'll probably end up talking about and have talked about really came about in part because of a specific political context in France, which was the idea that, I believe it was under Chirac, that if we, and we being the French, if you go from having a public entity like your municipal water provider and you privatize it, that they may be able to more competitively provide a better service. So it's part of a kind of specific moment in imagining how to manage public entities. Mm-hmm. And so the French model really involves a public-private sort of relationship. And if you think about it, once you privatize water or privatize, semi-privatize the production of water, aesthetic questions can become a selling point. Mm-hmm. And for the case of Lyonnaise des Eaux, which is one of the big water providers at the time that was competing for contracts in the city of Paris, they formed this research relationship with the American Water Works Association in the United States, and specifically folks at Drexel University. And that research relationship resulted in flavor profile analysis jumping from the United States and the US water context over to France. And so you had this collaboration of scientists going back and forth. And the French were really leading on the practice of, can we identify the off tastes and smells, the molecular culprits of those off tastes and smells in our water supply, in collaboration with these folks in the United States. And from there, they end up developing this tool for facilitating this conversation. And I think it's really important to recognize, one, the French have a long history of trying to describe foods. And two, there's a really big challenge, not just when you're talking between someone in, say, Michigan and Missouri about the differences in their water, but when you throw in that cultural barrier of a new language, how do you describe a specific smell? Is it lettuce or is it stink bug? Even if the same molecular component results in those different words. And so what they did is they borrowed from the wine world. Anne Noble, who was working at UC Davis, had developed, along with some colleagues, a tool for helping scientists talk about wine in ways that differed from how connoisseurs talked about wine. So it linked the molecule to the perceptual experience. It's a really great tool if you want to look it up. There are some pictures online of it. It's called the Wine Flavor Wheel. And the water scientists thought this is a really good tool for talking about these things. Scholar Stephen Chapin has referred to it as an intersubjectivity engine. These wheels, because they facilitate that process of talking together. And so through developing this tool, they started to facilitate their ability internationally to talk about the tastes and odors. And this was something that was really shared amongst many different countries at this time period.
And this concept of the future sensing body, how is that a term they used or that you've coined? And why is that a useful way to think about the function of this drinking water taste and odor wheel?
Garrett, thanks for bringing me back to the future sensing body.
Yeah, no problem.
Future sensing body is definitely a concept that I've developed through a combination of my own training in food science and through watching these practices. So when I was a student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, I took this class where we were discussing food processing and the different ways in which things can go wrong and how you can use your body to preventatively taste what might happen for someone else in the future. And one of the most telling ones for me is when we aged milk. So we took milk, we exposed it to UV light, we exposed it to heat. We had a way to accelerate the heating process. And then the next day we mostly just smelled them, but I think we tasted them too. And you could tell a major difference. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's been to grade school and had milk that's been frozen before in a carton and then thawed and consumed it, know that it tastes different, even if you didn't know that that was why it tasted different until I told you this.
I'm getting that sensory memory of the elementary school cafeteria right now. Yeah.
Similarly, like there are these painting notes that emerge when milk has been exposed to light or when it's been heated for improper handling. And what really emerged in the process is that we were learning to anticipate problems that could happen in the future supply chain and how that might be perceived by a consumer down the line. And this is why many of our best buy dates are actually early. Like your food may still be good. It's probably still safe to eat, but the quality, the sensory qualities are anticipated to begin changing sometime after that. So the companies are using those best by dates, not just to say, hey, food might not be safe anymore here, but more accurately and more often to say, hey, the food's not going to taste the way we think it should taste beyond this date. And so this future sensing body to me is an aggregate body. It's a body imagined in the future by food producers and a body planned for. So it's not necessarily your body, Garrett, or my body.
Okay.
It's kind of what happens when your average consumer can sense this. Does the perceptual experience fall below the threshold of detection, or does it fall above the threshold of detection?
Interesting. Yeah. And I would be remiss as a Philly guy myself. I'm just fascinated. I wonder what those conversations were between the French and the Philadelphia researchers when the Philly people kept referring to water. And I'm sure that the French, already confused by the American accent, you had the Philly mid-Atlantic accent on top of that. That must have been tough. Continuing this conversation, though, about the future sensing body and about these different methods, I mean, it was really interesting to read. There's these scientific approaches, these molecularized approaches. There are these more kind of what I think of as traditional consumer research, consumer science approaches. Then they developed this drinking water taste and odor wheel. And then we have in the early 20th century, the rise of bottled water. And so this is a huge part of, I think, the way many of us think about water today and really do think about taste. And there are these debates about, you know, what's the best tasting bottled water and is tap water just as good? And so there's all these efforts to promote the quality of these you know, for purchase bottled waters, but also a big response from folks producing tap water, and this concept of what you call the theater of taste used to make the case for these different products. What was this theater of taste, and is this theater of taste still something we're seeing today?
This is one of my favorite parts of the research, was getting to participate in the tasting in the streets, which I am drawing on Bruno Latour to conceptualize as a theater of taste. Latour has this concept of the theater of proof, where people could come and see spectacular exhibitions of, in the case he's using, the effectiveness of vaccination. And in contrast here, I'm thinking about the ways in which the French and many others around the world in the mid-20-teens started inviting people to taste tap water in the streets, which is a pretty, like when you think about it, it's kind of brilliant. Mm-hmm. Bottled water folks are marketing their product based on taste along with fancy packaging. And so at least for the city of Paris, what they did is initially they had this campaign where over the summer they were out in the streets offering people a head-to-head between their city water and Evian. The next year they dropped Evian and just moved straight into, hey, come taste our water and experience. Mm-hmm. And that is when I started participating. And alongside that, they developed a really great marketing campaign with these beautiful carafes. And on each carafe, it actually had what you could consider something like a nutrition label that described the mineral content of Paris's tap water, more or less similar to Evian. And mm-hmm. for the French, who are used to seeing information about their water on bottles, like this is the mineral content, and who are accustomed to making a connection between the mineral content label on a water and the gustatory experience they're going to have, this made a lot of sense. For most of us in the States, we don't have any conception of what am I looking at, if it's going to be a super salty water versus what if it's not, apart from saying, does it have a lot of sodium in it? And as people would encounter this water in the streets and be offered a glass to drink, if they chose to drink it, at least in my own observation, we saw a lot of folks who were surprised by the taste. Had folks say, but the water coming out of my taps doesn't taste this way. And it then became a really great conversation point for the people working for Eau de Paris to start discussing, how do you care for your water? Mm. What are the processes that you do when it comes out of your tap so it can, you can help it taste even better? Things like, well, you can chill it, or you can let it decant essentially for a half hour to let any chlorine that remains to keep it safe kind of evaporate out. And then you're really going to get to the taste of your water.
I also, as I was reading that, I was thinking throughout, like, how much of what of taste is psychological, and you know, maybe it doesn't actually taste different at their homes, but they just, you know, if they're getting this on the street and they have this kind of positive affect around the situation. I mean, is that part of this? Because there's also this, the history and culture of wine that you mentioned earlier is playing a role here. And I think about those experiments that have been done, you know, where somebody is, you know, told that this is a really expensive bottle of wine and they say how wonderful this bottle of wine is, but it turns out it's, you know, a $5 bottle of wine from the local grocery store or something like that. Is that part of taste here, our own perceptions, and what can we learn from wine? Slightly separate questions there, but what do you make of that, the sort of psychological piece of our taste here?
Sure. I'm going to start by addressing the fact that we may actually, even though the water being sent out is the same, we may be getting different tastes because we are all... The delivery systems we have differ based on our homes. I live in a home that was built in 1940, so I know that many of the water lines running through my house are older. In contrast, my cousin lives in a home that was built in like 1990 and then was further remodeled. So we've got right there, one of us probably has metal pipes and one of us has plastic pipes. Mm-hmm. And so that is a real thing that the municipalities don't actually have any control over once the water leaves their system and enters your system. It's beyond their care. That's both a strength and a weakness of the municipal water provisioning. Beyond that, Garrett, just remind me, you asked me what is it that the French bring to this process of tasting that we can...
Yeah, I mean, well, one, I just was thinking too about like how much is psychological and then, you know, can we learn from the wine, people's perceptions of wine about the role that sort of psychology and affect and branding play in the way we think about taste?
I opened my book with this recent water campaign by the city of Chicago called Chicago. And if the listeners get a chance, please look up the video that's linked to in the end notes because it is delightful. And it does a really good job actually poking fun at this link between psychology and our perceptual experiences. So it's well known that if I were to give you a water and put some red food dye in it and ask you what it tastes like, you would probably tell me it tastes like cherry, even if I had not added anything to it. So our tasting experiences are this multi-level thing. And this is part of what has allowed the bottled water folks to be so successful. Not only are many, at least if it's a mineral water, it is probably chemically different than your municipal water. It's probably saltier, maybe fizzy. But at the same time, there's some really pretty bottles out there. And last time I was in France, they were still selling Bling water, which goes for 70 or so euros a liter, which is kind of maybe 750 mils. It's a lot of money to pay for a beautiful bottle that has some water inside. I know many folks are enjoying drinking Liquid Death right now, simply because, from my perspective, the water's pretty boring, but the can is really awesome. And so there is this really amazing link between how we perceive something's going to be and how something actually is, which raises a question. Can we individually actually retrain ourselves to value the water coming out of our taps in a way where we say, this should be cared for the way a fine wine is, or this should be cared for and thought about as something really valuable, not just as something that I'm going to use to wash the dirt off of my vegetables. Granted, it gets to do both things, but that's how I'm...
Yeah, and maybe that's part of what makes it tough to do that, right? Because it has this, it's what we, wash our vegetables, it's what we shower in, it's what we brush our teeth with, but it also is this, you know, and it's essential, but it also has this possibility, this opportunity to be a real tasty beverage at the same time. It's tough to do all those things at once.
And I think here's where it becomes really important to recognize the unevenness of the municipal water supply, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. So one, countries like the US, Canada, much of Western Europe have really safe, highly regulated water supplies. And yet, as we've seen in cases like Flint, Michigan, that's not always the case. There's stuff that can undo those processes. And this is where I think valuing the aesthetic qualities of water becomes especially important because it, and when I say valuing, not just us as consumers, but also regulators. If regulators value the way that people interact with aesthetic qualities, it then would raise a moment when someone calls up to say, as happened in the case of Flint, my water looks wrong, my water smells wrong. And those looks and smells were not themselves the things that were dangerous. It was something that was imperceptible, lead. Mm-hmm. That was dangerous. If you can perceive lead, it's going to taste sweet in your water. So for many folks, that's actually attractive, which is especially concerning. But chunks of iron or other stuff from the pipes corroding are an indication that maybe something's not right within the system. And if you have a regulatory system that values that human perceptual experience, you are more likely to have a regulatory system capable of responding when someone complains.
Yeah, you know, there's this throughout this book, there's this real concern that these efforts to make water clean and safe and tasteless are actually hiding big problems in our society. And you just pointed to some of them. So you write about this concept of agnotology specifically, which is this idea of the social production of ignorance. So can you say a little bit more about what is it about industrial terroir that can make us less informed and what concerns you have there? You just mentioned some of them in the case of things like Flint, but more broadly, you know, what's the problem with, you know, the tastelessness and the safety and the focus and the just general way we don't think about our water?
This is just such an interesting conundrum to me, because I don't actually want us to go back to the pre-1900s world of water that doesn't have industrial terroir. We live in a world where our water supplies are, by and large, they're cleaner than they were in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, thanks to Rachel Carson and many others who have followed in her footsteps to help pass regulations and create systems of accountability. Our industries are less polluting overall than they have historically been, again, thanks to those movements. Yet at the same time, we have water supplies that have been damaged, and that, and we know now that certain bacteria, when present in water, can make people really sick. And one of the best things that has happened from my perspective and those of many others with regards to public health is we started chlorinating our water and treating our water. So I want to start by saying that a lot of the moments of ignorance, sensual or sensory ignorance, that have been created inadvertently or advertently throughout the 20th century have had this massive impact on our public health. So that's just so amazing that at least here where I live, I have access to clean and safe water that tastes good most of the time. At the same time, I recognize that I don't know, or if I weren't someone who was studying water, I don't know generally where my water comes from. I don't think about the fact that there's this whole system of canals and reservoirs. And I do think about the Colorado River, of course, because I live in Phoenix and that's part of it. But that I could be driving around and in different places in the Phoenix metropolitan area, drinking water that comes from vastly different sources and not realize it is actually kind of crazy. And that lack of knowledge to me, it becomes very easy to not pay attention to things like, oh, my municipality really needs a lot of it, additional money to help rebuild the infrastructure that they built 90 years ago. It's failing. And so how do I vote when I see a bond question? How do I respond when I hear my mayor or city council members or my state legislature talk about water infrastructure? Or do I even pay attention?
Yeah, it's as you know, it's a product of the successes in a lot of ways, right? That we now have this new set of problems, or that the success of the water management system itself can cover up some of these problems that might be, you know, more deeply rooted or might not be present in our water system now, but might one day become. So yeah, I as I was reading, I was really struggling with, you know, should I feel good about the system and its successes, or is it covering up for some, you know, kind of big disasters that might happen, you know, we saw in Flint and we've seen elsewhere. One of the big challenges you talk about in the final chapter of the book is this discussion of direct potable reuse, or DPR. And you mentioned, you know, you're near the Colorado River and Arizona there. So can you talk to us a little bit about some of the environmental problems and water management problems that make people believe that water reuse is necessary at all? And tell us just a little bit about what is DPR, direct potable reuse?
So direct potable reuse is a technology that's been around since the 1970s. And this is essentially water recycling. You take wastewater, you clean it, you clean it, you clean it some more, and then it's clean enough you can drink. And it's a really exciting technology in a sense. This is what allows human life to happen off of Earth. So all our folks in the space station are engaging in some way in a direct potable reuse system. It acknowledges that water exists in a closed system of sorts where we're all connected, that what you and I dump down the drain eventually is going to be someone else's drinking water. What it does do that's different from our current closed loop system is it cuts the natural environment out in a way. So you could imagine having a system where in a home version, stuff you flush down the toilet or the sink is sent through these series of processes and immediately is available to come out of your tap again. And I anticipate that for all of us, that might change what we choose to dump down our sink. Mm. And it might change a lot of other things too. But when you do it at a larger scale, which they're discussing in many states across the Western United States due to water shortage, it doesn't necessarily engage folks in thinking about what you're dumping down your sinks, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The reason it's so attractive right now, one, the federal government has been pouring money into this question, as have private entities, like I mentioned, since the 1970s, as a way of building resilience in the face of changing climate, in the face of population growth, and in the face of dwindling groundwater supplies. And if you've been paying attention to the New York Times, you've seen a lot of articles recently about groundwater.
And in this process, though, you know, we know a lot of folks have this initial yuck factor reaction to this idea of water reuse. And so beer, we talked about wine and the role it's played in this history. Now beer comes into the story a little bit. What is the role of brewing beer in trying to turn perceptions of this yucky process of DPR into something that might be a little bit more yum?
So this emerged in Oregon specifically.
Shocking, where everyone is, right? A beer brewer there, right? Yeah.
Turns out there's a company called Clean Water Services, and one of their board members happened to be one of the leaders in the Oregon beer resurgence. So they were discussing, hey, we're trying to help people be able to overcome this kind of initial long-held social reaction to the idea that they should be essentially consuming their trash. Art Lorenzen had suggested, hey, let's brew beer with this water. And what I think is so interesting about this process is just like the tastings done in the streets in that theater of taste in Paris, brewing beer with potable reuse water and then turning around and offering it to a public. And initially, ironically, the public was actually just folks working in the water industry, because you have to convince folks in the water industry they want to do this. It allows for pushback in a way that just building a new system doesn't, because you're essentially allowing folks to encounter the product and to encounter the quality of product in what many would say is a fun, interesting environment. Potable reuse water is great for beer brewers because it's water that's been stripped of everything. And beer brewers really like to have water that's stripped of everything, because then they can build the water back to the specific mineral content that works for the style of beer they're making, and then turn around and brew a great brew. And there's actually a brewery here in the Phoenix area right now that is working with Scottsdale Water, and they buy their water from Scottsdale, even though they're not based in Scottsdale. And Scottsdale doesn't have a complete online potable reuse system. They have a demonstration plant, but this brewery is buying beer from that demonstration plant, or not buying beer, they're buying water from the demonstration treatment train to go ahead and brew their beer with, because they're such a small brewery, they can't afford to install their own reverse osmosis system. And so instead, they've essentially outsourced it to Scottsdale Water. And for many brewers, that would be really exciting to not have to carry that cost themselves.
Yeah, really interesting to see if is that going to be the thing? Is beer going to be the thing that gets DPR to go mainstream? It's been, as you say, it's been around in various forms for quite a while. So again, this really a great sort of history of municipal water management, but also just pushing us to think about these bigger picture questions about what is taste, what is water supposed to be, what happens when we treat water like food. So I guess my penultimate question here is, after all of this exploration, what do you think our water should taste like? What should we be demanding of our water systems? And what should be the questions we are maybe asking about our water that we're not thinking about in this contemporary industrial terroir moment?
I'd love to say that I think our water should taste of the place it comes from to some extent. I want to put a little asterisk on that, though, because... You know, here in fall, in October, November, our water gets some really intriguing kind of musty, earthy flavors. And I taste it and I think, this is so cool. I know what's going on upstream. I recognize that it's cooled down. The flora that live in my water supply are really happy right now. And they're doing the things they do when they're really happy, which involves making these smelly molecules that cost a lot of money to remove. And so... I admit that I run my water through a charcoal filter to remove some of those things. Mm-hmm. And so the question for me is less, what should our water taste like? And more, what should we train ourselves to expect our water to taste like? One, can we find some sort of joy in the knowledge of those systems, like I just said? And two, are we comfortable or how might we learn to care for our water or become co-carers for our water in a way with our municipal water providers so that... we can support them in the process of trying to make the best tasting water they can that is also safe within whatever the fiscal constraints we as a community decide. To what, you know, what does it mean for me to be a co-carer? And three, I think there are some really interesting infrastructure questions that are emerging. I don't really address this in the book, but if we're hitting a point where our infrastructure is aging so much that we do have to reinvent it in the case of potable reuse, are there other approaches that we're not considering that maybe we should? Does the water I flush my toilet with really need to be the same quality as of water as what I drink with? Or could I instead have some really cool system where I've seen toilets like this, where like the hand washing station's right above the toilet and what you wash your hands with drains into, and then you flush your toilet with that. It's kind of a cool option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this has been great. Thank you so much, Christy. And I'll finish up with the traditional final question from the New Books Network. I know this was a labor of love, a long-term project here. So what is it that you're working on or thinking about these days?
So I am still thinking about stinky stuff and wonderful tasting stuff. I have started a project looking at sugar beet factories and the smells that they produce and how those intersect with memory after they close down, and also environmental contamination. So sugar, but also smelly sugar.
Very interesting. Well, we look forward to reading more from you. Once again, Christy Spackman is an assistant professor of art and science at Arizona State University and the author of The Taste of Water, Sensory Perception and the Making of an Industrialized Beverage. Thank you once again for joining us on the New Books Network, and congratulations on this great work.
Thank you, Garrett.